Welcome back, folks. Things are falling into place finally, and hopefully in this hour we'll get it all right. It's been a crazy day today. We want to thank you for your patience. We had technical difficulties earlier, and thank you for hanging around and hanging in there for us. We are joined by Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. The Louisiana legislative session is winding down, and Ron, a lot happened this session, but it was pretty much dominated by redistricting before it was all said and done, right?
Yeah, that was the big issue, and it's going to continue to be an issue because we still don't know to what extent the courts will allow the new plan that the legislature came up with, and so we'll have to see where that goes, but you're going to have an election later in the year for Congress, and it'll be different from what it was last time, but it'll be closer to what it was the time before. So if voters aren't confused over all of this, I don't know when they'll be confused.
Yeah. One of the things that I think you would agree, folks don't really understand this process. This is not something new, right? This has gone on for decades. And you've seen some states that have just been gerrymandering, you know, gerrymandered to ensure the election of candidates from one party and no other. And you've got states where it's blended. We've been blended for a long time, but because of the most recent Calais decision, things change, right?
Right. You know, traditionally, redistricting was done to protect incumbents. That was the first thing they did. And but then over time, more recently, you know, you had the Voting Rights Act, which required states to not determine districts based on race in a way that would keep black voters from having a chance to elect a black member of Congress. And then that criteria has changed as the Supreme Court has adjusted what that means and how you can use politics and how you can use race to determine it. Anyway, the bottom line is, you know, it's always difficult for a legislature to know exactly what they're supposed to do because the courts aren't always that clear, and it's not always clear what the requirements are. And but now it's becoming purely partisan, purely, you know, the Democrats are trying to create as many seats as they can. The Republicans are trying to create as many seats as they can. And it looks like that's going to be the new criteria, and unless the courts stop them.
You know, what was interesting is a lot of the rhetoric and the dialogue that was being used and this term being racist, being bannered about up in Baton Rouge for several weeks now. I was kind of mystified by a lot of that discourse because the manner in which the court decision came down, it was clear that the second minority district that was created fit exactly what the court was talking about, that they utilize race as the primary motivation to create that district, right?
Yeah, and you know, and of course, that's the other problem. People can actually use one criteria when they and then say they're using another criteria. So it gets difficult there to sort that out. But yeah, one of the things that I thought was disturbing, and I'm not attacking either side here. It's just the bottom line of it. Is that there was more racial division, I thought, in this legislative session than we have seen probably since, I don't know since when, because in the old days of segregation, when there was a lot of racial, you know, hatred and legislation moving around. You didn't have black members of the legislature. So so now we're in a situation where the whole idea of race is really dominated the legislative politics this year. And in the and in New Orleans, and it wasn't just the legislation on Congress, it was also legislation on a new clerk of court and what's going to happen with the judges, and all of that was sort of defined and seen as being racially motivated. So there were a lot of fractures this time. That's not good for the state in the long run.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It seemed to open a number of wounds. You know, for the city, I've been a little bit concerned because I think there were a lot of kumbaya moments over the past several months of folks trying to assist the city in the financial doldrums that they find themselves in. And I know that the city's going to be going back to the bond commission. They're going to need state help. They're going to need help from the state legislature in the future. And the way that the dialogue went, I was kind of like, you know, you've been around a long time. I've been around a long time. I look at it and I said, I don't know that these wounds are going to heal so fast. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, I think you're right. And in these in those kinds of wounds don't heal very fast. It takes a lot of work on both sides to bring people back together. And I'm concerned that that those wounds are worsening, not getting better. And again, we'll have to see where it goes. You know, legislative sessions have limited lives. They're over and done with, and then you've got to live with what was done. And I think after this session, I don't see where many of the politicians involved were particularly helped by it. I would think most of them sort of shared some of the blame for what happened. And so it ends up not a good thing for the state.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of folks were critical of dealing with that second district at this point in time. But I think I would agree with the governor. Why conduct an election for a district that's already been ruled unconstitutional, right? And it's kind of like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would we want to go through that exercise?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's in the voters' interest, too, because there's no reason to ask people to go vote on districts that ultimately aren't going to be there, so they can have to vote again anyway. But you know, one of the issues that this raises is, it seems to me that there needs to be some requirement, and I'm not sure whether Congress can do this or not. I think they can. I don't think it's against the Constitution, but to require that rulings related to ongoing elections need to provide enough time for states to call new, you know, to have elections and to have the rulings in time where you don't have to cancel elections and you don't have to push them back. But because it just doesn't seem to make sense. I remember some years ago back in the 70s, the New Orleans City Council was in the middle of a big reapportionment fight. And the current council members, as I recall, served over 6 years instead of 4 years because the elections were postponed for a couple of years. And that was just an abuse of the process. And I think while, you know, I understand the courts have the right to make these determinations, I think, they have a responsibility to protect elections, to make sure they're just, and they're fair and they're honest, but they should also make sure that they're orderly. in that you're not, you know, flipping a coin on when these elections are going to be held and what the district's going to look like right before, just literally as it happened this time, days before people started voting. And I think that's something that members of Congress from both sides could probably agree on.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you wholeheartedly. It's amazing, though, Ron, and I think you'll agree with this, how many people don't recall that that went on in the 70s and don't think that it was a gerrymander. I said it was absolutely a gerrymander.
Sure, sure. And, you know, and I mean, what's a gerrymander to one person is good government to another person. So, yeah. So you know, it really depends on whose ox is being gored here. And in those days, a lot of it was, like I had said earlier, about protecting incumbents, you know, making sure all the incumbents had their seats and they had districts as close as possible to the district that they won from. But, of course, now it goes beyond that.
Yeah. If we could pivot just to national politics for a second, I know that you always have your finger on the pulse of that. A lot of the Trump endorsed candidates have fared pretty damn well for the most part, and it looks like, though, that this is setting up for what I think is going to be a really volatile midterm. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with that too. You know, we've had presidents before who have had influence on their party, like Ronald Reagan was tremendously popular among Republicans, Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy, among voters in their party, as well as Barack Obama and some of the more recent politicians. But but Donald Trump isn't just popular among Republicans. He essentially controls the Republican Party. He's controlling who's nominated for what, and who's running for what, who gets money, who gets endorsements, and it's a level of control that we've never seen before. Now, he wouldn't be able to do it if the Republican voters didn't want to go along with it. So it's not just something he's able to do on his own. He's doing it because, you know, over 60% of the voters in Texas went to the polls and voted for his candidate. And here in Louisiana, we had almost 3/4 of the electorate voted for candidates who were acceptable to him in the U.S. Senate race. So he has a level of control that is really extraordinary. And we always knew he had a lot of influence on Republican primaries. But it's to the point now where he really has a hammer lock. And, my Democratic friends always come and say, well, why do the Republicans stick with him all the time? Why does Mike Johnson do whatever he wants? Why does, you know, so-and-so always go along with Trump? And the answer is because if they didn't, they would lose their job. Now, some people say, well, you know, these jobs aren't worth not doing what you think is right, so go ahead and risk losing your job, as Bill Cassidy did. You know, if he hadn't voted to convict Donald Trump after the impeachment, he wouldn't have lost re-election this time. He would have sailed into an easy election. So it has big, big political consequences, and we've never seen this before.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because he is lame duck, right? And do you think the traditional downsides to being lame duck are going to apply to him as he approaches the back half of this 4-year term?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he's a lame duck as president, but he doesn't appear to be a lame duck as leader of the Republican Party. And that's a big difference. You know, usually presidents in the last couple of years of their term, even though they're still doing things and pushing things they want done, their political involvement may not be as much, and because they're sort of turning over the reins of power to somebody else. Well, Donald Trump ultimately has to turn over the White House. I don't see any legal way that he could run again, but that doesn't necessarily mean he has to turn over power over the Republican Party. And he's very much not a lame duck there. He's very much a quacking, running, walking, alive duck when it comes to being a leader of the Republican Party. And, you know, the question is, how long does it go? Will he try to pick the next Republican nominee for president? Probably so. Will he oppose members of Congress or oppose presidential candidates in 2 years from now? Who aren't supporters of his within the party? Of course he will. So that could just continue going.
Yeah, that's going to be telling to see. You know, because part of the when you have that kind of influence in the party, it's because you've got all the trappings of the office, you know, out there that loom. And that translates into more and more authority inside of the party. Once that's removed, it's kind of interesting to see where this all goes, right?
Yeah, but it really depends on the voters, you know, what yeah. they want to do. Andrew Jackson had something similar where his pick for president with Martin Van Buren and James K. Polk were elected president. So even though after he left office, he had a number of presidents and a lot of members of Congress who still supported him and went along with his wishes. So we did see some of it then, but this is more so than I think we've ever seen.
No, absolutely. As always, Ron Fauché, totally enjoy the conversation with you, sir. Appreciate your time and your insight, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. You want to check that out. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. One thing that really matters, population size. And here to talk to us about that is Tim Slack, professor of sociology. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Newell. Thanks for having me on.
And that's at LSU. I forgot the important part of that. But Tim, thank you so much for joining us. So, Tim, I saw this article, you know, in NOLA.com about our population size in Louisiana. And I was really struck by how many, and you talked about how many of these smaller towns are really being impacted more than some of the urban centers. But they're equally as important as the others, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're seeing a lot of change across the communities in our state, and that has, you know, big implications for all sorts of things, including, you know, the provision of services and tax bases and so on. So, you know, if we look at this most recent data that I was talking about in the article that you referenced, I mean, the headline trend is that our major cities are losing population, while smaller suburban and exurban communities within metropolitan areas are seeing population growth.
Right. But the more rural areas are shrinking at an incredibly fast rate as well, right?
That is true. That is true. I mean, the biggest losses that, in percentage terms, that we're seeing are small towns in the Delta, in the northeastern portion of our state. But we got to be a little bit careful about some of those population estimate numbers, because the way the Census Bureau does the estimates, you want to be really cautious with interpreting numbers on populations below 10,000.
Right. So we should always have our eye on in-migration versus out-migration. We should always have our eye on the socioeconomic factors behind that as well. What do you see that's happening here? Are we have people moving around the state but staying intrastate, or is it some of the population loss that we're having, both intrastate as well as moving outside the state?
It's a combination of both. So what we're seeing within the state is, as I said before, our most populous cities are losing population. So between 2020 and 2025, that group was led by the city of New Orleans, which has lost over 21,000 people. But three of our top 10 saw gains, and those were Bossier City, St. George, and Lafayette. Lafayette led the group with a gain of nearly 2,000 people. The places where we're seeing the greatest growth, though, are in kind of smaller communities that are nearby to metros. So if we look at, for example, let's see here. So if we look at the 10 communities with the greatest absolute growth over the last 5 years, only two of those are what we would call principal cities. Those are the economic hubs of metros, a Baton Rouge and the Baton Rouge metro, or a New Orleans and the New Orleans metro, and so on. Only two are principal cities, and those are Hammond and Lafayette, respectively. The rest of the places that we're seeing the big growth are smaller communities, primarily in the Lafayette and Baton Rouge metros, and these include places like Youngsville outside of Lafayette or Gonzales outside of Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
In terms of state trends, one of the things that we're dealing with in this state and have been dealing with for quite some time, really with the exception of about a 10-year period post-Katrina, is that we have consistent out-migration from our state. That is, we have more people, what we call negative net migration, that is, more people moving out of our state than are moving in. So over the last 5 years, we've had about 50,000, let's see. So statewide since 2020, we've lost about 40,000 people. We've had about 50,000 more people move out of state than in, but we've had 10,000 more births than deaths over the period. The two major things that change populations are migration and then what we call natural change, which is the difference between the number of births and the number of deaths.
And so if we were having this conversation to look into your crystal ball in 2030, we're in 2026, 4 years from today, we're looking at 2030. With these trends, do we see where there's any significant disruptors headed our way that would alter these trends? And what do you suspect we will find in 2030?
I mean, I don't see anything radically shifting these trends in between now and 2030, to be honest with you. I think one disruption is, obviously we've been having a very difficult time in our state coming up with congressional maps, right? And those are going to need to be reevaluated once again come 2030 because the population is shifting and changing. One disruptor that we always have to keep in mind is if we have any kind of catastrophic disaster along our coast. About half of our state's population, over 50%, lives in the coastal zone. Okay, so that is a vulnerability, and obviously, if people sometimes people sort of hop, kind of leapfrog mm-hmm. inland, right? And sometimes people pick up and make a much bigger move. So I think, that's something that we have to keep an eye on. But like you said earlier, I mean, the other thing that we need to keep an eye on is that when you look at the places where we're really consistently losing population, those are more in the northern half of the state. North Louisiana is consistently losing population. Most of our population in Louisiana is on the I-10 and 12 corridor. I mean, that's where our people are.
I spent some time yesterday talking with Michael Heck and other business leaders about a number of the projects that are going on around the state. For the first time in a long time, we have major projects going on in almost every parish. I mean, it's kind of a unique thing that's going on. And I'm curious, do you see that? Obviously, it's going to help to some extent, but we don't really can't get our finger on it until probably what? Post completion of these projects, 3 years, 5 years?
Yeah, that's what I would think. I mean, when you're talking about some of the big industrial projects that have been announced, right? There's going to be a big boom in construction jobs for a time, you know, and some of those will be filled by local folks, and some of those will be filled by more migratory tradespeople. You know, the question I think is once these things are up and running, how many permanent jobs are being created, and can that create a pull? You know, when it comes, the way to think about migration is that people react to pushes and pulls. So there are some factors, jobs, good economic opportunity, affordable housing, quality public schools, those things pull people towards a place. Right. And then there are mm-hmm. other things that push us away. Right. And so those can be things like a lack of affordability, a lack of jobs, concerns
about a hurricane,
public safety, a hurricane. Yeah.
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 And that's, I guess, for us, I mean, have you looked back historically to see how much of it, you know, hurricane is a big risk factor, right? I mean, and how much of that is actually really influence where we find ourselves today?
Yeah, to a degree. So I mean I've looked back over time at parish level population trends, and there's no doubt that I mean you could see the major changes after Hurricane Katrina, right? I mean we lost a significant share of our population for a time, and then for the about 10 years following that, we actually had a period of in-migration, right, where we were, what we call positive net migration, where we have more in-migrants than out. And, of course, that was people that were coming in to do rebuilding or coming in to work on recovery efforts, but also people coming back. What the data seems to show is that period really played out from basically 06 to, you know, 2014, 2015, and then we sort of reverted back to our older pattern of primarily exporting our people. And one of the things that I always talk to my students about that I think is important is that, you know, we talk about many of the things that we export from the state, you know, in particular talk about oil and gas exports, but the most important the most important thing that we consistently export is our people, especially our educated young people. And that's what I think as a state, we need to do a better job at you know, retaining folks and then also creating conditions that recruit new ones in.
We were having technical difficulties earlier this morning, and we went off air, and one of my first guests was going to be Steve Malloy from the National Center for Public Policy Research, and we were going to talk about this phenomenon with some of these major tech companies and their heavy reliance on the H-1B visa program, you know, bringing foreigners in for these highly technical jobs and so forth, and there's a move afoot by a bunch of stockholders and companies to oppose this heavy reliance on H-1B visas because of that very reason that you just talked about. They get a lot of consideration from local government, state government. They locate a facility here, and, you know, there should be a stronger demand to create that lure that you talk about having these jobs, you know, that pull to have these jobs. Have you followed that phenomenon at all?
I mean, I'm aware of it. I haven't followed it that closely. I mean, it seems to me that what we need is, you know, a balanced approach that makes sure that we're not structuring immigration in a way that displaces working people in our country, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, to the degree that we have, you know, gaps in our own labor force, right, we don't want to stifle economic growth that can help to gin up more right. economic activity, which is good for everybody. So there's a balance somewhere there, but I'm not sure I'm qualified to say quite where it is.
Yeah, it's just kind of interesting. I mean, because we have a lot of things going on with these similar type of tech projects going on right now, and that's why I wanted to have him on, you know, to talk more about that and this heavy reliance on this H-1B visa program. It's kind of dormant to some extent right now. And obviously, I guess that's hurting kind of population growth numbers too, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that actually had been helping the population numbers for a few years in our state was international migrants. But we are seeing, you know, obviously that tap is not turned off, but it's been it's closer to close than it was a few years ago.
Yeah, and that'll be interesting to see what the
take. And that has implications for all kind of industries. I mean, the other one that I was hearing about on the news this morning was just the difficulty that crawfish farmers are having with people, sure. Especially the processing.
Yeah. Now, there's no doubt that there needs to be a robust legal immigration process. It's just I don't know why we have so much difficulty maintaining a legal immigration process to keep it alive and well, as opposed to, you know, being stuck on stuck relative to illegal migration to this country. It's interesting that, again, as you pointed out, there's got to be that healthy balance, because you want to make sure that you're always moving the economic needle in a positive direction, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the way I see it is that it's exactly what you just said, and the issue I think that we've been having in our country is that we're swinging way to one direction on the pendulum and then way the other way, right? Without just saying how do we center economic growth and the well-being of working people in this country. And I think, yeah, if we could make those things the focus, we could get to a place that is a little more stable.
Well, that's where that filthy, ugly word compromise comes into place, right? it's amazing how that has become such a nasty thing, right? I mean, it's like, it drives me crazy. It drives you crazy as a sociologist, yeah, as well, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. Tim Slack, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time, your insight, and have a great weekend. Tim's a professor of sociology at LSU. Thank you, sir.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you.
We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. On the text line, I sure am glad WWL Radio is back. And trust me, we are as well. And we thank you for your patience today. It's been a little bit of a roller coaster ride, but it's been a little bit of fun. Right, Coleman? He's been juggling balls.
Family,
he has been juggling stuff throughout this entire segment from 10 to 1 today. And I thank you, Coleman, for your patience as well and hanging in there, and everyone else as well.
All I heard was the wine is on you this weekend.
Yeah, exactly. And congratulations to all of the members of the WWL team being recognized here with regional four regional Edward R. Murrow Awards. I don't know if that's the most we've ever received in our history. I'm sure someone will be able to tell us shortly. And on to the national competition now to see where we ultimately stand with the national award. So congratulations. A lot of great stories. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot? It's been a free-for-all so far today. So it's
testing. 1, 2. Test. Yeah. Check. Check. Mic check. 1, 2. Mic check. You know, you'd think that after all these years of mic testing on stages at rock concerts, they could come up with something better than check. 1, 2. Check. Check. 1, 2. Check. Mic check. 1, 2. But, you know, it remains today. All right, so if you think our show is unorganized on a regular basis, it's going to be very unorganized today because it is Free for All Friday. We'll talk a little bit about the Saints. There's also a new song out, which is about drinking. And I thought about all the songs that encourage drinking. If we're so concerned about rap music inspiring violence, why aren't we concerned about songs about drinking inspiring drinking with young people? So we'll play the song, and we'll talk about that this afternoon. And let's see, what else? I don't know. We've just got a whole bunch of stuff to get to. A little bit about politics, but not too much because it's Free for All Friday. We do like to take a break from that. And heading into the weekend, looks like it's going to be some nice weather. An interesting moon to look at over the weekend. So we'll talk about that, that as well. And Newell, have a great weekend.
You too, my friend. Scoot's headed your way with a great lineup, folks. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Thank you so much for your patience today. Have a great weekend. We'll see you again Monday morning.